We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the next generation of differentiation, the path to more powerful personalization. I'm from Dreambox Learning. My name is Jenny, and I'm thrilled to partner with EdWeb on this great webinar. And now I'd like to introduce our fabulous presenters today. Maddie Ahern, I don't know if you can wave there so everyone knows who you are, but she is the curriculum administrator in the Eugene School District 4J in Oregon, where she oversees curriculum and instruction in mathematics, science, health, and PE for grades K through 12. She has over 12 or 11 years of education experience, with the majority in the secondary math classroom serving as a teacher and instructional coach. And you can follow her on Twitter there with her handle. And now I'd like to introduce Kelly, who started her education career as a teacher in 2002. She has her national boards and master in technology and curriculum development. She also taught sixth grade for 10 years and has a big passion for math. She's now a senior curriculum designer here at Dreambox Learning, where she has the opportunity to create lessons, develop technology-based teacher partnerships, and influence the way students learn math. And with that, I'm going to pass it over to our presenters.
Hi, everybody. Thank you so much, and Maddie, for joining us. I'm going to be presenting for a little while, and then we're going to bring Maddie back in to kind of talk about her real-life experience in Eugene School District and how they've actually implemented technology to innovate with personalization. So thank you. All right. So today, what are we going to talk about? Personalization, personalized learning. What is it? We're going to be talking about how to take differentiation into even a further place. So past differentiation into that personal learning strategies. We're going to talk about technology. How can the pedagogy and curriculum be enhanced using technology and not just replacing what you're actually doing in your classroom right now, but making it even better. And then, of course, we're going to be speaking with Maddie again about her experience in the Eugene School District in Oregon and her evolution of personalized learning through technology. So as we get started off, the first thing we want to do is talk about personalized learning. Ina Cole's definition is talking about personalized learning is knowing and acting upon each student's strengths and providing the opportunity for student voice and choice, choice in the what, the how, the when, the where, all the while providing that flexibility and support and feedback through high expectations and standards. You can even see on this graphic here, it shows the continuum of what makes the comprehensive personal learning situation. These three pillars are learning and motivation, philosophy for schools, and then the principles for districts. To personalize learning, we're not just talking solely about this individual classroom. To truly transform the way that kids learn, we need to look at the district and the school levels to really move into that personal learning movement. Here, Allison Zamuda, for those of you not familiar with her, she's an education consultant and also the author of Students at the Center, It's Personalized Learning and Habits of Mind. It was written for ASCD. And she has a slightly different view of personalized learning and the attributes that contribute to a successful model. So she outlines the differences as well, looking at this infographic about personalized learning versus individualization. Because oftentimes we're using those two words interchangeably, and they are a little bit different. But her main ideas on this whole piece of personalized classrooms is really focused on the students and what the students are going to be doing. You can reference on this the teacher's role as well, but I'm really looking at the bottom of this infographic for what the key points are. And again, not really a reader of slides, so please feel free to kind of look in, dive in. And if you have any questions too, make sure you're jumping on because Jenny will be collecting those for the Q&A at the end. But her main ideas and attributes, voice, student voice. Do they have choices in what they want to pursue next? This isn't as general as it sounds either, because that sounds very macro. In a micro way, we're looking at how can we create opportunities for them to have choice in different subjects, in math, in reading. Any choice is going to raise that student engagement and help them take responsibility for their own learning. co-creation. Co-creating choices that includes goal setting and performance options. I know as a teacher, my students were most engaged in their learning when they set goals themselves, collected data to support them, and then reflected on them in the end. I saw improvement in areas that may not have been my number one piece that I wanted kids to focus on, but because they were so much more excited about creating their own goals and pursuing them, they became more engaged and then, therefore, turned into a larger piece of their learning itself. And I like the idea of performance options because there shouldn't just be one way to show mastery. There shouldn't. I mean, we should be looking at several different ways for students to be able to show that they have understanding. Social construction. So collaboration, knowledge that has to be gained and shared beyond the school walls, knowing that it's not all about them and so egocentric. It's not just about the classroom, but well beyond that brick and mortar setting that we see students in now. And then self-discovery. And any teacher, educator that's out there has already learned what reflection can really do to help your practice, but it's the same for students. What could they be doing better? What are their strengths as well? Oftentimes we sit in that negative, what can we do next time to improve, rather than really focusing on our strengths and what accomplishments they've already made. So now that we've talked about this a little bit, I want to talk a little bit about learning. So we've talked personalization, now let's talk learning. Here, Grant Wiggins and Jay McTee talk about how it's so powerful that understandings cannot be given. How true are those words? I mean, how can we expect a student to learn about a topic that I'm telling them about? We want understanding and eventual application, which is completely born through a student making sense on their own with guidance and support and feedback from the educator, of course. But we use that term personalization and differentiation interchangeably, as well as that individualization that we looked at a couple slides ago. But to me, differentiation is something that the teacher does to or for students, where personalization is actually what the students do. They participate in their own personalized pathway that is differentiated for them, maybe from the teacher, or maybe they even have some choice to be able to move forward in their own chosen pathway. I really like this personal trainer analogy. So let's say I called a personal trainer to interview them to see if they were going to work best for me. And they didn't ask me a single question about the present me right now. How much do I currently work out, my diet, my goals, my timeline, my time available with two small children, come on, what is my time? But they only cared about my age. Now, that's the way we often have our classroom set up. You're 11 years old, you're in sixth grade. But if they only asked me as a personal trainer about my age, and they said, you know what, I have the right trajectory for you, it's a perfect pathway, I wouldn't believe them. How could you? How could they not start at this right place with my impediments and my strengths with any kind of consideration? So I'd be better off looking for a training video on YouTube because I'd probably get the same out of it. I need it to be personalized to me and what I need and taking into consideration my goal. So my starting place, my end place. My end place might be walking a 5K with my 6-month-old in a stroller. And it could be versus running a marathon and not stopping once, which praise to you if you can do that because that's amazing. But there's a difference between what my goal could be, not just my age. So with that said, let's talk about the classroom. All right, so let's pretend this is the typical classroom, even though there are several reasons why it is not. One, who wouldn't kill for 9 kids in a classroom, right? Or the fact that this was taken 100 years ago. Or even that all the kids are looking at the camera at the same time. So maybe not truly typical, but let's say that this part is typical. The pacing calendar today says, you know what? You're going to be working on fraction operations and you're going to be doing fraction operations from January to March because that's what the pacing calendar says. And the testing in May says you have to do this then. But glancing at your students, you go, ooh, they might not be in the same space for that same learning. This girl in the back of the room, she hasn't been challenged all year. The little guy in front, he's like, I haven't even been successful once. I'm about to give up. And this guy in the middle, he's got that Goldilocks, right? It's just right for him. But is it really going to be hitting every student in your classroom? Why is it that we are doing this? Because these students are all born in the same 12-month window. You're 11, You're in sixth grade. Here we go. We've got fraction operations. And oftentimes, even as a teacher, we have other limitations. There's seat time, you've got the pacing calendar, you've got testing at the end of the year, you've got age-based classrooms. And then, of course, you're given materials that maybe are more skill-based or competency-based, and it's difficult for me to really personalize and differentiate from my entire classroom. Even if you had 9 students, it would still be a reality. However, my last year, 32. 32 just in my classroom. And that means not only did I have 32 stinky sixth graders, but I also had to try to figure out how I'm going to engage them in learning that's in the right place for them, which always was this incredibly daunting feeling. So now that we've looked at this like micro classroom level, let's talk about this kind of macro level, systemic. How are we going to take the system and change it so it really fits in? I've even seen someone over here in the chat that said that they've been really working on personalization in their school this year. And so really talking about it on a more systemic level will allow us to kind of figure out what are we doing and is it going into the right place? So we see this quadrant grid. We see to the left, schooling. This is what adults are doing. This is teachers, educators. This is school building administrators, district administrators, parents. This is what the adults are doing. And we see it goes all the way to the right-hand side, which is learning. What are students doing? So there is a difference there and a continuum of what we've set up as adults and what students are seeing at the end. We also see this vertical alignment here, where we start at the bottom, which is impersonal or industrial, and moves all the way up to more of that personalized relational experience. So what do all these things mean? Well, one of the easiest ways is to kind of ask these questions so that you can connect to it. First of all, if we're looking at personalized schooling, what are you ready to learn? Is personalized for that child? And then what do you think about it? So moving into personalized learning. Now that you have started in the right place, what are you thinking about your learning? What are you exploring? What are you critically thinking about? Whereas if you're looking at more of the impersonal or industrial schooling, you're talking about when were you born? It's that age-based classroom. And then it's moving into what did someone else tell you to think? I'm taking someone else's information as a teacher and I'm handing it to the student saying, here's the information that you need to have. So they're not making their own thought. They're not using their exploration, critical thinking. They're just being told what to do and moving forward. So we're not talking just about learning. We're talking more about creating ideas in that upper right-hand corner. So let's go back to our ideal classroom, right? 100 years ago. And we're talking a little bit about how each of the kids are feeling. You know what? The girl in the back, she's like, I got it. I know how to win school because the teacher does something. I go home, I do the problems on my own, and I come back and I've got it. It seems really similar to the kind of experience I had growing up until, of course, I was in college when they actually made me think about math. And then I had to move forward on my own, which I struggled with because of that experience. Little guy up front, he's like, I get it in class, and then I get home and I don't get it anymore. How many of us have experienced this with our own students? They understand what you're talking at them, but they're not making any learning or connection to apply it on their own. And this isn't even application. This is just practice. Oftentimes kids get home. I don't know how to do it. Parents don't know how to help. Is that truly learning in the first place? And then the guy in the middle, he's like, you know what? It's boring. It's the same thing. It's lecture, practice. And then you're going to test me on it. It's exactly the same thing. I'm not really in it for anything else. All right. So kind of back to our quadrant. Again, we go macro, micro, macro. And back at this macro level, we're talking about schooling. And what do these really mean? So we've got personalized schooling and industrial schooling. So what does industrial mean? It's all about policy and structure. We're talking a lot more about schedules, location, usually in a brick and mortar setting. The pathway of students is rigid. You're in third grade math or third grade in general, and you're really ready for fifth grade math. But what's your pathway going to be? Your pathway is going to be moving on to fourth grade so that you're not actually moving based on what you're able to do or what your interests are. It is based completely on the pathway that's been set up for you in the structure. And then age-based pacing calendars. And it's a reality. It's not necessarily a bad thing that we all have things that we need to cover in the school year, but it is limiting that we only have certain things that we can teach during the school year if you're following the pacing calendar. Whereas personalized schooling is a little bit different. This is more designed for unique students with unique strategies within schedules, locations even, the pathways. And then of course, the pacing and curriculum along with learning is unique for the students. Whereas if we're looking about the learning aspects, what the students are doing, if we're looking at this industrial learning part, we see this as kind of this mass instruction. So teach, practice, test. This is really the math education I received. You know, listen, take notes, go home, do the homework, go over the homework the next day, and then boom, rinse and repeat, just like shampoo. It's the same thing over and over. It's that sit and get information from someone else. And it worked well for a while. Like I said, it wasn't until I got into the higher level inquiry-based math where I was like, ooh, now I got to think for myself and not just use other people's thoughts. The personalized learning aspect is empowering students through their experiences, critical thinking, creativity, exploration. It's a lot more think and do. So I'll use those words a few times, sit and get, meaning they're just sitting in their seats. They're getting the information from someone else, and that think and do, really thinking about it. They're not having the learning experience where someone's just telling them and they're just doing it over and over. It's more of a creating the meanings themselves. So now that we're moving into this blended learning experience at age, really, we see that technology is part of the classroom. If you're not already there, you'll be there soon. Technology can be and should be part of a well-rounded classroom experience. So blended schooling and blended learning, we're looking at the difference between just, okay, here you go, here's the information, to how can you take technology and make that into a better situation for everyone. So people often ask, what does that mean? What does blended learning within blended schooling mean? Well, then we hear, is there an app for that? And they're looking at it and going, okay, is there an app for me to do school structures? For example, in the personalized schooling, do you have a way that students are all signed in or connected to each other through technology? But remember, we really want to look at that personalized learning section, which is that top right green corner, which is really empowering learning through the students, but trying to figure out if there's a digital solution. And there's many digital solutions out there. The hardest part is figuring out what quadrant is this really going to belong in. And the ideal is for your solution to be in that top right green corner, because it allows students to guide their own learning through exploration and conceptual understanding. So let's say that you are moving toward technology and technology solutions in your classroom to help personalize learning. Well, Fullen and Donnelly released this paper about essentially assessing digital programs. And if you haven't had a chance to read it, I highly suggest it, particularly if you're trying to bring something into your classroom that's going to engage and enhance student learning. In fact, I find this quote so important that I'm actually going to read part of it to you. And I hate reading slides, and so we know it's important. But this beginning part, so technology-engaged innovations have a different problem. It's mainly the pedagogy and outcomes. Then skipping down a little farther into the green, most often in the form of introducing concepts by video instruction and following up with a series of progression exercises and tests. So this is going in and saying, hey, this isn't actually doing anything different other than putting something on a computer. And that's what we really want to avoid. If we go back to our last slide here, if we're just putting something on a computer, are we empowering learning? Or are we really just looking at, all right, this is still that mass instruction lecture, but I'm going to be able to provide it on a video form, rather than in a way that kids are engaging in it. So video instruction, it's nothing more than just digitizing that sit and get. It's really not helping students with the think and do. being able to listen to something again and again is just repeating lecture versus being able to get in and start engaging in a mathematical context, for example. So one of the ways that we can assess technology is looking at the SAMR model. If you're not familiar, I will be explaining it to you using this analogy of, I wonder what's in the ocean. But it's a great way for us to assess technology integration into our classrooms. Because technology offers so many incredible opportunities, we need to be selective of what we're putting our students on, let alone if we're using classroom time. As a teacher, people would say, hey, we have an assembly. I'd be like, oh my gosh, that's just another piece of time that I'm missing with my kids. How am I going to make this up? So you need to be really selective when you're putting your kids on anything to make sure that you're using your precious time as productively as possible. So here we are. This guy's like, I have no technology. I wonder what's in the ocean. If nothing else, he's even starting this really thoughtfully because the student is asking, I wonder what's in there. This first piece, substitution. That means that technology acts as a direct substitute. There is nothing that's actually enhancing. There's no functional change, but the guy is now on a canoe. He's not under the water. He can't even look in the water because if you've ever been in a canoe and you lean over, well, you're going to fall right out. So maybe that would be a functional change, but let's just say he stays in the canoe and he can't get into the ocean, doesn't know what's down there. And unless you live in a place like Hawaii that you can see into the beautiful water, you probably can't see anything else. We're on the West Coast. We've got really murky, dark water. So the next piece, augmentation. So it's acting as that direct tool, but it's got some functional improvement. So we're snorkeling. We're under the water level. We're being able to see some fish, not everything that's actually in the water, but we've got some piece of it. This third one, which is definitely transforming, it's modification. It allows for significant task redesign. So now we've got that scuba gear on. We're down, not all the way down to the bottom of the ocean, but we've got different levels that we can go down. We're not just staying on the very top the way you would with a snorkel. We can go down a little bit deeper. And then, of course, we want to redefine or redefinition or have redefinition in what we're using and making technology even more applicable but comprehensive in the classroom, which allows for you to do a new task that you could not do before. It was previously inconceivable. So we can take the submarine and we can go all the way down to the bottom of the ocean and really see, what can we not see when we're scuba diving? Definitely can't see when we're snorkeling, and not even a possibility to see if we're on the canoe or land. So let's talk about that with technology. If you are actually looking at for just an enhancement, like substitution, you just want a PDF of the worksheet you would have given in class. Let's talk about best practices in the first place, but also, is that what you want to give? Is that the technology you want to make sure that you're connecting in your classroom? Or do you want to take it and transform how students are learning, which is that enhancement to transformation? So if we're looking at a PDF on an iPad substitution, let's say that you've got something that has a can grade for you. It's a worksheet that grades it for you. That could be augmentation so that you are not having to do something. There is a functional improvement, but it's the same type of thing. So again, we're looking at schooling versus learning. The schooling changes what the teacher is doing, but the learning does not change what the student is doing. And then, of course, there are programs that have to do with modification and redefinition because they're taking students into the program and having them work and discover and be creative. And the whole purpose then is to make sure that students are transforming what they're learning. One example, Dreambox. So to continue on with this virtual manipulatives from 2002, which obviously before many of the virtual manipulatives that are out on the market were even out, it's just another publication that saw even well before they were able to move into true integration in the classroom, but visionary. But they're looking for a couple different pieces. So this first chunk of the quote is talking about how users can get on and it is more engaging if they're working with dynamic objects. And couldn't agree more. it is more engaging. It's in there. They're moving things around. Kids love computers, games, any kind of screen time. You know, you often hear, even my two-year-old now has figured out that he likes our phones. but we want to make sure that we're really focused on this green part again. Through the interaction, the students have opportunities to make meaning and see relationships as a result of their own actions. So, of course, engagement is wonderful, but that main part is that personalized learning, that individualization part of having the opportunities to make meanings and create and see relationships. And as they're doing that, they're kind of starting in that early sense-making engagement aspect where they're really looking at the beginning of their conceptual understanding and moving all the way through fluency. But seeing that structure and being told how to use structure is different than them going in and discovering how to use that structure, how to use different strategies that they weren't even told. And then all of a sudden, it's, oh, that was the Kelly strategy because that worked well for me. I invented it, even though several hundreds, thousands, millions of people have used it before. So with me just yapping at you, for a long time, we've had the opportunity to explore the what, the why, the how of personalized learning. And even at the end, talking about technology and technology assessment of how you can figure out where technology fits in your personalized plan. Now we have the opportunity to actually talk to someone who in real life, real district experiences, has had her own personal evolution of personalization. welcome, Maddie Ahern. She's the curriculum administrator for the Eugene School District 4J in Oregon State. Thank you so much for joining us so we can kind of talk some main points of what you've done in your district.
Thank you. Thanks so much. And I just want to say thanks to all the folks putting ideas and suggestions in the chat box. I've already stolen a bunch that you've already shared with one another. So this is a two-way street here.
That's excellent. I know. While I'm talking, I have a hard time reading at the same time. If I pause, it's because I'm trying. Oh, that looked good. So I look forward to looking through all this as well. And I'm sure Jenny's collecting lots of questions. So if you've got any, make sure you're popping them in there. Particularly for Maddie, because she's got this real life experience as a district administrator. I did see one question a while ago that said, mm-hmm. How can we get our administrators on board with this? This might be your opportunity to take some ahas away. So Maddie, tell us about your school district.
Great. So we're in Eugene, Oregon. I haven't seen anybody pop up from Oregon there. So we're about 2 hours south of Portland, which most folks know. We're considered about a mid-sized district for Oregon, 17,000 students. That's broken up over actually 19 elementary schools, a couple of language immersion programs in there that are slightly smaller, 8 middle schools, 4 comprehensive high schools, each with 1,000 or just over 1,000 students each, and 1 alternative high school that runs programs for juniors and seniors that are either credit deficient or want to access college courses a little bit earlier. So we partner with our community college on that with that alternative high school. We're a predominantly white community, so we don't have a ton of not a high level of diversity, and we kind of reflect the proportion of diversity throughout Oregon State. We have a University of Oregon is in Eugene, so we just attract a lot of folks from around the world because of that. And so we're again mid-size school district.
Excellent. And actually, the chat box has been blowing up with people from Oregon. So
hey,
we got Oregon people.
Alicia, yay! Okay,
that's great. All right. So as that's any, cute. Oh yeah, right.
Sorry.
As any district sits down and they're looking for innovations in the school district, they're trying to answer a problem. So You were identifying a problem. What was your problem in your school district?
Yeah. So I loved your conversations earlier about kind of personalizing a system, personalizing a school or in a classroom. Really, what I was looking at was really specific. I was analyzing the problem that we had in our middle schools in particular with math intervention. We didn't have a consistent model for math intervention across our 8 middle schools. And it varied from as much as none. So students just went through their core math classes, and as a teacher was able, they differentiated for those students, Oregon, I'm sure a lot of other places are struggling with this as well. We've got 30 to 40 kids in a middle school classroom. I mean, I was just in a sixth grade classroom last week with 42 students in it. So asking a teacher to provide that level of personalization or differentiation when a student is struggling in mathematics is really difficult. So we have, that was the problem. What was going on with mathematics intervention? To exacerbate that, we also don't have the most efficient data collection system, just to be really blunt. We do a lot of post-mortem. You know, we have our instruction that happens all year long, and then we test them at the end. How did we do? So we were really lacking that data along the way to provide any sort of timely intervention. And that was a huge part of the problem as well. One other piece, if we had an intervention, so I had that spectrum idea before. So some schools didn't have any, just kind of all kids going through core math. The schools on the other end of that spectrum had an additional period in the day where a student would go and receive additional math instruction. And at the highest level of that spectrum, that additional math class was taught by a grade level math teacher. So a teacher that knew what was happening in the student's core class.
Wow, that, even that's an improvement.
Yeah, yeah. So that time was there, that person was there, but still is talking about identifying the problem. What was happening in there wasn't also consistent for a student. The student's lived experience in that room depended on so many different variables that there was some improvement and some growth that could happen in that respect as well.
Yeah. Well, and even just hearing 42 kids in a class, I think I got chills and not in a good way. So this next piece, you've identified the problem, you've seen what is happening in your school district, and you know that you need to do something. Mm-hmm. So what did you do? What was your next step? How did you look at even potential solutions?
Yeah, so we went to the research initially and tried to see, okay, what's best practice? If we had all the resources in the world, all the time in the world, what does the research say we should be doing for students who we know are struggling with mathematics? And there was the jury sort of out in terms of an actual ideal model, but the general theme through most of what we found was that students need more time. If they're struggling with mathematics, they absolutely need more time. So that idea of our schools that were able to provide an additional period to support mathematics, they were on the right track. And then what the research said to do during that time is a combination of reteaching and pre-teaching. And this that's not new, that's not revolutionary. It's just what the research has consistently said works for students that struggle with mathematics. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of our first step towards solution, that we wanted to do both of those things. So then I kind of worked with a bunch of teachers to try to figure out, okay, so how do we do that? How do we operationalize pre-teaching and reteaching if we can get this extra period for students to have that math support class? On the pre-teaching side, what we decided to do was to take a look at our core curriculum, and we've had a scope and sequence for what happens when kind of that that calendar of, you know, fraction operations is from January to March idea. We had that laid out. So we said, okay, if a kid is struggling with this, if this is not what they're ready for, or if this is not what's kind of in their zone of proximal development, what are the best things to pre-teach them so that they can kind of have a leg up when they go into that core class? And what that ended up looking like is us using kind of the focus documents from the Common Core State Standards, where it clearly says not all math standards are created equal. So if you're going to hone in on a couple of standards, what should that be? And then we looked at our scope and sequence for our core class, and we said, when? So when are we going to emphasize this if they're about to do that? And that gave a much more narrowed focus for interventionists to be able to hone in on. I'll talk at the end. Right now, everything's sounding really good. So I'll talk at the end about what reality looks like. But this was all in our kind of evaluating of potential solutions, how to make pre-teaching work. On the reteaching side, that's where it really fits with the topic of the day. Because if I have 14 kids in my math intervention class, they are coming at me with 14 different sets of skills and gaps, and they just have a different lived experience, a different way to approach mathematics. And so that's the side that we could not figure out how to scope and sequence. You know, how do you scope and sequence reteaching when you have all these different skills at you? So that's where I decided to pursue technology as a potential solution. Just knowing that adaptive tech was becoming more and more advanced, and the Common Core had been out there long enough for I was hoping software developers to use the map of the Common Core, I went looking and evaluating different technological tools. And so we created a really explicit rubric of what we were looking for. We used Ed Reports, that they have a set of gateways and evaluation criteria that they evaluate core curriculum with. And so we use that to tailor it down, because we're not looking for a core, we're looking for a supplement. And we created our rubric, and we went out and we took a look at just a lot of the common programs that are out there. There's like iXL and MobiMax and Dreambox and a lot of other different programs. And we wanted something that focused on that major work. We're not going to go back and be able to reteach all of elementary school mathematics and get this kid caught up. So we really wanted it focused on the major work. And my big thing, and the thing that kicked most programs out, was this notion of coherence. We have a progression of standards in mathematics, but the pathway in which a student progresses rarely, ever, if ever, looks the same for a way a student makes connections. So I wanted a software that said, okay, if you're struggling with, you know, with the concept of ratios in sixth grade, that could be because you don't understand some fraction concepts from third, fourth grade. It could also be because you don't understand partitioning from kindergarten. You know, there's a variety of reasons. And so that was a big piece that we were looking for when we went out to find that kind of personalized pathway in order to be able to reteach. And I think that's how I reevaluate. So that's pre-teach looking and the reteach piece.
And I love that even in the pre-teaching part, you're looking kind of at that focal points from the standards. If nothing else, it sings number sense. Like number sense, it's so important that you have that because of your perfect example of the reteaching too. Looking at ratio tables, well, is it the multiplicative reasoning that they haven't gained, you know, in middle elementary school? Or is it all the way back to they really don't understand partitioning? I love those examples because it's so true. You start getting into the middle school, high school time and you go, oh, wow, there's holes that are totally different from all example that you said, 14 different students that you're trying to work with. Where are you going to fit with all of their holes? Mm-hmm. So moving into implementation. Mm-hmm. So how did you implement with Fidelity, particularly when you're looking at it from that higher ed, those kids that maybe don't want to be working on something extra with something they're already struggling in?
Yeah. So this is also something I'll return to in reflections around how actually well in reality it went out. But the intent was to for once in our district provide guidance for folks about what to do with this time if they can get the time carved out of their schedules, and then resources to use in that time. So when we talk about this implementation with Fidelity, it was more for us this year, it was more about what in the world should I even be implementing, and then we could work on this notion of like getting it to a degree of fidelity. So what we laid out is 90 licenses to Dreambox after doing all the evaluation. That was the adaptive tech program that rose to the top for our 8 middle schools. So each middle school got 90 licenses, so that's about 30 students per grade level. And then they got kind of access to the scope and sequence that said, if you have this time, this is what you could pre-teach to. And then you have the Dreambox tool for reteaching. And based on the nature of resources in our state, some of our schools had a core math teacher that taught that double dose class. And so the students maybe had sixth grade math with them early in the day. And then later on the day, they came back and they had access to Dreambox and pre-teaching. It also pre-teaching also kind of took the path of homework help, which often I know is shied away from in intervention models, but I sort of believe with our core curriculum, it actually worked. We have a reteach pre-teach or review preview is what they call it. We use college preparatory math in our middle schools. And so the homework actually fit in line with our model. And then they had access to Dreambox. Another thing that I thought was really important, and I just found like mixed use in other people's experiences in other districts, is that we were an all-inclusive, at least my recommendation was all-inclusive in this support. That means SPED students are right part of this conversation. They're not, like, they don't go to an other intervention group. And so that, again, is one of those things that's being implemented with various degrees of fidelity, but that was really important to our model as well.
Well, and you've alluded a few times about what happened in reality. So
yeah. Let's talk about it. Here we go.
Because truly, theoretically, we have all these really big macro ideas of what we want our district or our schools to look like. And then you start getting into that micro systemic situations and you go, ooh, all right, what really happened?
Yeah. So the first thing that happened probably within 3 or 4 months of Dreambox licenses being out in the middle school as part of this plan is that caught on really high. So we had a bunch of elementary schools that adopted and paid for licenses for their entire school. We had some special education administrators reaching out and saying this is a support that we need in our high schools for some of our students that are 3 or more grade levels behind. Mm-hmm. And I think that a lot of that had to do with the adaptive nature of this tool and the fact that it represented good math. So you referenced a couple of times in your presentation this notion of, you know, practice and worksheet, and they're not getting it. So here, let's give it to them 7 more times, you know, with different numbers. And that, I mean, frankly, is really what a lot of our math intervention still looks like today in this country. And so the fact that they saw something. And I don't think it's lack of people knowing that that's not what's best. It's lack of people knowing what else to do. And so the fact that they saw Dreambox as a way to a lived example of conceptual understanding and visual mathematics that was adapting to students is why that caught on. So lots more usage of this tool. The model itself is what I reference a lot in just not being there. I mean, I kind of laid this out as this is a recommendation, and we still have our spectrum. We still have schools that have absolutely no additional time, up to schools that have for 6th, 7th, and 8th an additional period with a core math teacher doing it. That teacher appreciates Dreambox for the reteaching component. Still does a little bit of, you know, their own pre-teaching and a variety of homework help, but they have some instructional aids in there that they use for homework help. But the reflection this year is just, we need more time to play out this model, and we need to have that constant feedback loop of where schools aren't implementing, you know, what are those barriers and what's keeping them. And my suspicion, just from being at the district level administration, is time and money are the biggest two barriers. I also
and
want
we've
to
never heard that before.
Yeah. Totally just an Oregon specific problem with education.
Yeah.
those schools that used the program and had this kind of rotation style model where they worked with a teacher in a small group to do that pre-teaching or just in time work, and then they rotated out to use computers to do a Dreambox time about like 15, 20 minutes a day we tried for, and then they might rotate to a station with homework help with an IA. Those schools saw tremendous growth. I mean, that's a grain of salt because it's in program data. Again, we still just have postmortem data in our district where we only have that end of year assessment. But, you know, even if you scale back program data, it's still, we saw really good gains in those schools. And what really makes me excited is that the elementary schools that, that bought in are where the biggest gains are happening. And so that just, I'm really, from a K-12 perspective, if we can keep that gap close or non-existent at such an early age, you know, if this isn't, hopefully it's less and less of a problem that we need to be addressing down the road.
Yes. And I know you talked even about the kind of that summative data. So at the very end, I'm kind of looking at it as postmortem. But what about teachers? What are teachers saying?
Mm-hmm. So I think it's tough in June, you know, when we have 6 days to the summer. So they wish that they had I think, more of a consistent model for support. So the vast majority of our schools that have a support class, it's either not taught by a highly qualified math teacher, you know, it's just has a kind of an extra help time, and or it is it's mixed grade levels. So we talk about 42 kids in the classroom with this varying degrees, and it's just their age that puts them in there. Now we widen that to three different grade levels, all people that struggle. So you just can imagine the varying degrees of support that they have to give. So I think that that's just a struggle in our system with being able to provide that time and support. And I think that, but the overwhelming response from teachers regarding the program itself is that they do like it. We did expand it up to high schools, and I think the most common negative response about Dreambox in particular is just it's designed for K-8 students. So I have a 16 or a 17 year old on this program, you know, and they're looking at images designed for a 16. That said, that's like a 50-50. 50% of them are like, this is too childish, and 50% of them love it. Just the images. And that's the overwhelming response.
No, that's good. We want to hear from kids and we want to hear from teachers. As much as the data really is supporting kind of that assessment at the very end, you know, we always have really good summative data, right? At the very end of things. Hearing from kids and teachers and even administrators is really where we're going to collect that formative piece. So now that you've actually had some of this, what are your next steps or things that you want to do the same? What were the strengths and weaknesses in both? But what's your next step?
I think a real concrete next step is to just bite off less so that we can actually chew it. I think this year we had so many different initiatives, this being one of them, that it didn't get as much attention as it absolutely deserved. And frankly, even just bringing all those teachers together three or four times during the year would have made the model so much more sustainable and so much more consistent. So increased focus so that those teachers can collaborate more. During that time, another concrete next step for us is to provide professional development on those other components, like you alluded to one before about these kids are, this is their second math period of the day. They absolutely do not want to be there, most of them. It's a concept they struggle with. And there's a lot of wonderful research around like Joe Bowler, Carol Dweck's work around mindset and motivation. Yes. And there's a lot of resources that we could be doing during that time that are both developing their, you know, computational thinking and their number sense, while simultaneously addressing some things around their mindset and who they are as a learner. So that I think is a huge area of growth for us. And we can really partner with our special education team as a district. I'm sure we're not the only district where things get siloed. And so initiatives kind of run maybe parallel or maybe conflicting, as opposed to being able to come together, which uses less resources. So that's a really great next step for us. And then I think another more kind of nuts bolts one is for that pre-teaching component, providing teachers aligned resources that still maintain that depth of rigor in terms of conceptual understanding for those items. Because what the scope and sequence looks like is, okay, we're doing this in our core math class, and these are the topics we'd like to see you pre-teach to in the intervention class. And if we're lucky, it's a math teacher who knows what those concepts are, but they still might be like printing off a CUDA worksheet or something for them to be pre-teaching that to, as opposed to saying, here's a rich conceptual task that you could be doing with your class to get them ready for what we're doing in the core math class. And then the last piece is, you know, we had for a brief moment a wonderful model at one of our middle schools where the core math teacher and the special education teacher had common planning time. And what an amazing result came of that. They were able to talk. The core math teacher was able to show the special education teacher the models and representations they were doing. And those kids just, I mean, it was really tremendous growth that year. So another next step would just be shining more lights on those bright spots to make sure that folks know what is possible when we invest some resources in making sure that teachers can talk with good resources to be able to use in their classroom.
No, that's great. And really, you hit the nail on the head with so many initiatives happening at the same time. Sometimes there's too many things coming at you and you don't know where to focus. And even I'm incredibly impressed even with your reflection of what to do next. Plus, with professional development, you listed off like two of my favorite ladies. Well, we can't thank you enough, Maddie, for talking to us about your real life experience. Because truly, as much as we can talk about this higher level thinking of what would be ideal, it's really hard to implement in a in an entire district setting. And so, thank you so much. But now we're actually going to have Jenny come join us again, and let's talk some question and answers.
Yeah, well, this has been really exciting in the chat box over here. There's a lot of great questions and conversation. So one of the big overarching themes that I've seen are around how to change the mindset around sit and get to personalized and individualized learning. And this is both from the perspective of younger students or students who maybe can't be as independent, and also from the teacher's perspective. So we'd love to hear more on kind of how you approached that in your own district, Maddie.
Sure. I think that the one of the first steps, I'm going to speak mainly from the math lens, and I know I'm seeing a ton of other content areas come up in the chat area, but math professional development is my area of expertise. We run first a Foundations of Math Summer Institute for our elementary teachers, because one of the this isn't really research-based, it's just my experience, is that elementary teachers, if they're not confident in the conceptual understanding of the mathematics themselves, they rely on rules because it's a really comfortable place to go. They know what works. It's really step by step. There's not a lot of variance to it. And if you rather, if you are comfortable with the conceptual understanding of the math content, you're more apt to put out a problem and see what the students come up with, so that you can pull on those ideas and select and sequence them and build to a greater depth of understanding. So one of the ways we've approached it in our district is to support teachers in developing their foundations of mathematics, their conceptual understanding of mathematics. And it's, you know, there's a perception of, you know, it's elementary math. It's I have a math degree, and when I went back to learn the Common Core math standards, I calculate completely differently now than I did before I got this job. No joke, my computations are more efficient and effective because of the using our place value system. You know, it's incredible, but I learned algorithmically when I was in school, and so I didn't have the benefit of that. And then we run a math teacher leaders professional development in our district. A couple years ago, we were lucky enough to have it happen K-12, where we had teachers, you know, kindergarten teachers, calculus teachers, didn't matter. We all went in to an elementary math classroom, and or beforehand, we planned a lesson about like, what does it really look like to support mathematical discourse, productive struggle, some of these things we talk about in theory. What does it actually look like to plan that lesson, observe that lesson, and then we came back and reflected on it. And we did that again at the middle school level, the whole group of teachers, and then again at the high school level. And so that model allows teachers not to just be, you know, told do this or, you know, given the math content, but let's go do it together. You know, let's get into the messy classroom and play with it, and see what we can make of it. So those are just two concrete ways that our district has tried to support that.
That's really great. So we have a kind of opposite spectrum question here. So on the other side, as a teacher, how do you convince admins or district people to jump on board with personalized learning and maybe move the district more towards that path?
Well, I was lucky enough to see that question while you were talking, Kelly. So I saw somebody else actually answered it the way I would have answered it, which is most admin do make their decisions when they're given a time to make a decision, using research. So I think that the more that we could put this research that was presented today in front of them, and then the same way, like I just described, trying to shift to teachers' practice by being able to see it in action and collaborate with others around it, the more we can shine some bright spots on some districts that are doing it or schools that are doing it, so that admin can see it in action. Yeah, I think those are two ways that could work.
Great. Well, we have time just for one more good question. And this is kind of a more observational question. What did you see or observe in students that were engaging more with the personalized learning approaches as opposed to just individualized learning?
I think, I'm trying to think of like a specific instance when I saw the two differences so I can answer that less like what I think I would have seen. Well, let me talk about the one school that kind of had that model where they had support class every single grade level. And I think that now I'm sorry. That teacher is really good with personalization no matter what. So that's not a really good example. So let me just theoretically, what I would imagine is I would see more growth. Because if you're individualizing and you're saying, okay, very teacher-centered, you know, this is where we need to go and this is meeting what I see on your data's individual needs, as opposed to allowing a student a degree of choice within that. Which, you know, like the program that we go with, there's six different pathways a student can choose all within their pathway to move them forward. So we see more, and I would imagine we would see more engagement and higher growth. But I'm sorry, I can't think of something off the top of my head that specifically answers your question, whatever it was.
No, that's great. That's a great example, and a good way to bring in, the value of student choice and voice, in their own learning. So I wanted to send you both a special thank you again for all of the great information you shared. The chat, like I said, there's a lot of great questions and comments. So I know hopefully after all of this, you guys will be able to see that on your own. So now we're going to just take this opportunity to talk a little bit about Dreambox Learning, which is our sponsor. We're going to start with these three pillars. So Dreambox is an adaptive online K through 8 math program, which is designed to complement classroom instruction, and it's proven to positively impact student outcomes. And we have these three pillars you see, which symbolize our student experience. So on the one, we have adaptive, where Dreambox is really adapting to students' actions in real time to meet them at the right level, responding to each learner with personalized instruction, promoting student decision making and strategy development. It's also rigorous, so it's designed to meet the needs of our 21st century classrooms, promoting exploration, conceptual understanding, and fluency of math. This is all developed, delivered through a curriculum that is standards aligned and evidence-based. So we're really encouraging those students to experience productive struggle, problem solving, and thinking through those ideas and strategies. Dreambox is also motivating. We offer an engaging environment that motivates those students to persist, progress, and achieve success through adaptive learning experiences, providing just the right amount of support when they need it. And of course, no student would be successful without their teacher. So Dreambox is also educator-focused, enabling teachers to prepare students for success while providing unique insights to help in teachers understand how learners are thinking and responding to math concepts so they can more effectively support students while setting goals and fulfilling state standards. So this is just a brief synopsis of what we do. You can kind of read through the bullets, but I'm going to skip through this slide just for the sake of time here. And I'm going to talk about this really important slide. So Dreambox, our technology has won over more than 40 top education and technology awards. It's also used in United States and Canada. A third-party independent study published in 2016 from the Center for Education Policy Research at Harvard University suggests that Dreambox learning math increases student outcomes. And you can kind of see that on the chart there. As it shows, the study indicates that students that use Dreambox Learning for 14 hours could achieve an increased assessment on the NWEA MAP assessments by nearly 4 percentile points. You can also see a copy of the actual study done by Harvard on our website. And as you know, virtual manipulatives are really important in allowing students to bring math concepts to life in ways that pencil and paper can't. And this is a way that Dreambox really engages and moves students to that truly personalized learning. And finally, we also have a key, professional development to help empower our teachers. You can customize a professional development plan that is aligned to your specific district and school goals. And we also are just now announcing a new innovative professional development offering, MyFlexPD, which empowers teachers to gain a deeper understanding of math so that they can more effectively raise student achievement. It's an on-demand component that is self-paced and uses real-time student learning data to deliver PD that is relevant and actionable to what students are learning in Dreambox. We have a ton of great free resources on our website, so we hope that you'll stop by and visit us. And you can go visit us online at dreambox.com, where you can also request a demo. Thank you again so much to our presenters, Kelly Urlacher and Maddie Ahern, for sharing such great information, and to EdWeb for hosting these wonderful conversations.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording and take the corresponding CE quiz. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.